Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa. God knows you put your life into its hands, and it's both cradled you and crushed. But now it's time to make your own demands. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, an out-of-the-box think tank about community sovereignty and regenerative economics. We look at how to take back our cities, farmland, and water, our money, production, and trade, our media, education, and culture, our religion, and even our God. We present a people's history of the Bible and a parent's view on how to raise giving kids in a taking world. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Radio Free Brighton, Free Radio Santa Cruz, Upstart Radio Online, and through the Unwelcome Guest Collective. Multimedia transcripts to all shows are available on the website at thirdparadigm.org. Welcome to the 63rd episode of Third Paradigm. This week's title is Connecting the Dots. DOTS is an acronym for Deepening Our Thinking on Sovereignty, one of the first courses being taught in our newly opened Universe City, which can be found as a blog at universecity.us. Rather than just a one-room schoolhouse, this is at present a one-student schoolroom, although our enrollment triples on weekends when my other daughters are home. Weekdays, it's just me and Veronica, the daughter newly graduated from high school. We spend 3 hours every morning cooking and watching Democracy Now!, listening to recorded lectures, watching videos, and talking about the shows or the books we're reading. Our current book is Derek Jensen's Culture of Make-Believe. Veronica has just finished reading Chris Cleave's Little Bee. One topic leads to another, and there's no shortage of good material from the independent media. The other week we saw Elizabeth Warren on Democracy Now! I've just finished reading the book she wrote with her daughter, called The Two-Income Trap. One of the things she talked about was the need to build change into the Consumer Protection Agency, and her request to the Netroots Nation that they help her with that. Designing for change seems like a novel approach, but it actually goes back 2,500 years to the Tao Te Ching. The Tao Te Ching, from my understanding, is required to be translated anew every 50 years so that it never becomes frozen into doctrine. Unlike the Quran, where translation is forbidden, the Tao encourages interpretations by those who don't even read Chinese, the most famous being Stephen Mitchell's. Other favorites of mine are Ursula K. Le Guin's, which is subtitled A Book About the Way and the Power of the Way, and my friend John Mabry's, which is called God as Nature Sees God. One of our assignments has been to read all three versions of a passage, and then to write our own. For our poetry selection today, I'll read Ursula K. Le Guin's version of Passage 2, and then my own, and Rainier Maria Rilke's Book of Hours, Book 2, Verse 16. The music is Isolate by Moby from the Wait For Me CD. Soul Food. Everybody on earth, knowing that beauty is beautiful, makes ugliness. Everybody knowing that goodness is good, makes wickedness. For being and non-being arise together. Hard and easy complete each other. Long and short shape each other. High and low depend on each other. Note and voice make the music together. Before and after follow each other. That's why the wise soul does without doing, teaches without talking. The things of this world exist. They are. You can't refuse them. To bear and not to own, to act and not lay claim, to do the work and let it go, for just letting it go is what makes it stay. Ursula K. Le Guin, from Lao Tzu, Tao Te Ching, A Book About the Way and the Power of the Way. By contrast, when a woman is singled out as beautiful, all of her companions become plain. Eve bit the apple of judgment and saw good, but evil settled in as its dark bruise. Comparison produces opposition. Without it, no task would be difficult or easy. A journey would be neither long nor short. A person's status, neither high nor low. Both pride and shame would be equally absurd. Reality is, don't take it so personally. Meet each day with curiosity, like a stranger you'll never see again. In this way, you'll become indifferent to uncertainty, to rain or to shine, for better or for worse, in sickness or in health, because life and death aren't apart. Teresa Caraggio. Book 2, verse 16. How surely gravity's law, strong as an ocean current, takes hold of even the strongest thing and pulls it toward the heart of the world. Each thing, each stone, blossom, child, is held in place. Only we, in our arrogance, push out beyond what we belong to for some empty freedom. If we surrender to Earth's intelligence, we could rise uprooted like trees. Instead, we entangle ourselves in knots of our own making and struggle lonely and confused. So, like children, we begin again to learn from the things, because they are in God's heart. They have never left Him. This is what the things can teach us: to fall, patiently to trust our heaviness. Even a bird has to do that before he can fly. Rainier Maria Rilke, from Rilke's Book of Hours, Love Poems to God, translated by Anita Barrows and Joanna Macy. That gorgeous piece of music was Isolate by Moby. This is Third Paradigm, and we're talking about Connecting the Dots, our new learning blog responding to Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! You can find it at universecity.us or link through our website at thirdparadigm.org. It isn't unusual for religion to intersect politics in our lessons. Last Saturday, we watched Democracy Now!'s interview of Percy Schmeiser, the Canadian farmer who took on Monsanto. My daughters think that Percy and his wife are adorable and can't believe that any nasty company would threaten these sweet great-grandparents. They're really disturbed that Monsanto's VP of Public Relations gave the keynote address at a conference on ethics at their dad's alma mater, the University of Arizona. On the show, Percy went on to state the Schmeiser principles of food and agriculture, which were the following. 1. All humans have a right to food or to produce it. 2. Natural systems must be protected so that they can produce healthy food. 3. Humans have a right to safe and nutritious food. 4. No rules should prevent countries from controlling food imports. 5. Everyone has a right to information about how their food is produced. 6. Regions should have the right to regulate their own agriculture. 7. Local production and consumption should be encouraged. 8. Seeds are a common property resource. 9. No life forms should be patented. 10. Terminator seeds should be globally banned. 11. Farmers' freedom to exchange seeds should be protected. And 12. Farmers should have the right for the land to be free of genetic contamination. Then this Saturday, we went from Percy Schmeiser to Guns, Germs, and Steel with Jared Diamond. This is the three-part documentary he produced for National Geographic. It answers a question posed to him by a native of Papua New Guinea. The question was, why you white men have so much cargo and we have so little? Diamond explains that cargo means goods. After years of research and reflection, he gives his answer in one word: geography. Civilization spread horizontally from the Fertile Crescent. Because Eurasia was so wide, as opposed to the vertical Americas or Africa, crops and domesticated animals could easily adapt at the same latitude. This left people the leisure to develop superior weaponry, razor-sharp rapiers and guns. They also developed resistance to the diseases that their livestock introduced later to native populations. Diamond glosses over the intentional introduction of smallpox through infected blankets, but he does show the deception and trickery used in the conquest of the Incas, which was similar to the ambush of the Aztecs or the scorched earth tactics used against North American tribes. How did a handful of Pizarro's men, 169 to be exact, defeat the 10,000 soldiers of Atahualpa? Diamond attributes it to a strategic mistake by Atahualpa. He brought his men unarmed to the supposedly peaceful meeting. But the real reason, he says, the Incas didn't stand a chance was the guns, germs, and steel with which nature had graced the white man, who was the innocent benefactor of lucky geography. But nature's gift wasn't the way the white settlers would have termed it. Their advantage wasn't geography, in their eyes, but God's confirmation that they were the favored race. James Lowen writes about the Massachusetts outbreak of smallpox in Lies My Teacher Told Me. The English separatists, already seeing their lives as part of a divinely inspired morality play, inferred that they had God on their side. John Winthrop, governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, called the plague miraculous. To a friend in England in 1634, he wrote, "But for the natives in these parts, God hath so pursued them, as for 300 miles space, the greatest part of them are swept away by the smallpox, which still continues among them. So, as God hath thereby cleared our title to this place, those who remain in these parts, being in all not 50, have put themselves under our protect." However, I would argue with Diamond that germs weren't the only thing that indigenous tribes hadn't built an immunity to. They also had no resistance to a religion that had no concept of honor. Again and again, Christian generals and their friars take the native chiefs completely by surprise with the same strategy, the bold-faced lie. From the repeated success of this maneuver, it seems that it was unheard of for a leader to behave so shamelessly, or should we say, psychopathically, and still be respected by his followers. In the same way that business doesn't create psychopaths, but allows them to flourish, so this virginal territory that had never known deception was easy prey for a religion without a conscience. Without this ideology, there would still have been psychopaths like Columbus, Cortez, and Pizarro, but they would have been seen as what they were, mercenaries and pirates. Without a religion of imperialism, we wouldn't be celebrating those who slaughtered and enslaved every civilization they encountered. Let's take a break for some music. This is U2 with Mothers of the Disappeared. On our website is a very moving video of this song, produced by 11 Bass. The lyrics are as follows. "Midnight, our sons and daughters were cut down and taken from us. Hear their heartbeat, we hear their heartbeat. In the wind, we hear their laughter. In the rain, we see their tears. Hear their heartbeat, we hear their heartbeat. Night hangs like a prisoner, stretched over black and blue. Hear their heartbeat, we hear their heartbeat. In the trees, our sons stand naked. Through the walls, our daughters cry. See their tears in the rainfall." This is for both the ancient and the modern Incas, the Quechua and the Aymara people in Peru, Ecuador, and Chile. That was U2 with Mothers of the Disappeared. We go now from Indian Feather to Indian Dot, as someone termed it, and from Peru to India and Brazil. Let's read my November 1st post entitled Shadow Wars and Guerrilla Presidents. Today's Democracy Now! Headlines included an attack on Arundhati Roy's house by the Indian version of the Tea Party, because of her position that Kashmir isn't part of India to begin with. This is like saying Puerto Rico doesn't belong to the U.S., even though we beat it, well, square, if not fair. At the same time, Brazil elected Dilma Rousseff, their first female president. But that's not Dilma's real significance. She's also the first guerrilla president, a former member of the armed resistance who was jailed for 3 years and tortured for 22 straight days. What's this world coming to when an insurgent can become president? But in Yemen, there may soon be U.S. drone attacks and hunter-killer assassin teams who don't need the permission of the Yemen government. This is in retaliation for the printer bombs that originated in Yemen and were sent to synagogues in Chicago. The British government believes they were due to detonate mid-air, and John Brennan, the White House counterterrorism advisor, agrees. Neither gives a reason for why Yemeni terrorists would want to blow up a FedEx cargo plane, nor why the mission failed. On Russian radio, I heard speculation that it was done to boost the Obama administration's popularity during the midterm elections. If that were the case, it failed more miserably for Obama than for Al-Qaeda. Or did it? The tip-off for the printer, craftily buried in a box of books, scarves, and household goods, came from the U.S. and United Arab Emirates. Using the finest of sleuthing techniques, the woman was traced and arrested through the phone number she gave when she posted the package. This exceptionally clever explosive can be detonated by a mobile phone. However, I didn't know that mobile phones could call into cargo planes. The same chemical was used by similarly inept underwear bomber, who flew without a passport, and the Times Square bomber, who conveniently left his wallet and house keys in the stolen car. The 22-year-old woman who posted the bomb and gave FedEx her real phone number has been released on bail after revealing that someone stole her identification. This is fortunate for her. According to Amnesty International, alleged terrorists have disappeared or been detained for long periods without charge in Yemen's secret prisons. The U.S. gave Yemen $155.3 million to, quote, carry out the necessary operations, end quote, in 2010. A Wired article by Spencer Ackerman states it this way. The intercontinental mail bomb plot this weekend didn't result in any fatalities, but if its real purpose was to draw the United States deeper into Yemen, where the plot was hatched, then it might be a different kind of success. An intense and more lethal CIA role in Yemen, without cooperation from the weak Yemeni government, might be imminent, indicating that another undeclared war is about to intensify. President Saleh of Yemen is online to receive another $1.2 billion in military aid from the U.S. This may persuade him to open up some airports for launching drone attacks, which is the weapon of choice for wars of impunity. Is it ever moral to kill for a cause you wouldn't die for? And then, if there are floods in Yemen, as there were in Pakistan, they can divert the water from the airbase and let God do the military's dirty work. Maybe global warming is smallpox 2.0. In a final post on Connecting the Dots this week, I asked, what's your breaking point? On Tuesday's Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader asked a darn good question. Amy grilled him about the danger of ending up with the greater of two evils if votes get diverted from the lesser one. His answer was, what's your breaking point? How bad does the Democratic Party have to be, even though the Republican Party is worse, before you break away and stop being captured and taken for granted, the way African Americans have been taken for granted by the Obama administration? That's the key question everyone has to ask themselves as a voter. What is your breaking point? If you don't have a breaking point, you don't have a moral compass. It's interesting that he used the term moral compass, because morality, as I understand it, has to do with how you treat others, not how others treat you. But what the U.S. does to other people isn't even a talking point, much less a breaking point for the voting public. In this issue of World Beat, put out by the Institute for Policy Studies, John Pfeffer points out that foreign policy played almost no role in this election. Despite the fact that the U.S. is involved in two wars, military spending is off the charts, treaties and negotiations hang in the balance, and our last chance on climate change is coming up this month. If we have a breaking point, it's over jobs, health care, taxes, abortion, or gay rights. In other words, issues that affect us or people we know. But foreign policy affects each one of us every day. It's why we can't make a living producing goods or food. It's why there's gang violence in the schools. It turns a nice comfy word like security into meaning a nasty military escalation. It backs us into a corner with only our screen world for escape. By the time that we get into an election, though, the Democratic Party has us over a barrel. Actually, they have us in a barrel, going over a cliff and grasping for twigs to hang on to. There are no good choices to be made. So how do we break with this current that sweeps us into the rapids every 2 years? The problem, it seems to me, is that the party makers are framing the debate with meaningless questions and then picking straws to see who'll take which side. Since the real questions won't come up, it's a given that there won't be any meaningful answers. Their position statements are a buzzword bingo, with no actual strategy, other than raising taxes for the Democrats or for the Republicans cutting cost. It's time, I think, to bring back the non-binding referendum. It may sound innocuous, but it was threatening enough to instigate a coup against the Honduran president Mel Zelaya just before he went through with it. Why is it so dangerous to ask people what they think? Referendums, unlike elections, aren't about personalities. They're about issues. They're not the final laws with all the fine print after the politicians are through with them. You can actually understand them. And once that public opinion is known, it becomes a horse that any politician can ride, as long as he's willing to go where the horse leads. The referendum process doesn't need to happen at the voting booth. City councils could set it up as a computer survey, with a question of the month. Instead of yes or no checkboxes or unfinished arrows, ordinary people could enter into the debate. Rather than issues like panhandling ordinances, local communities could find their moral compass on questions like torture and drone attacks. Now that's what I call a breaking point. You've been listening to Third Paradigm with Teresa Caraggio. Thanks to Arrington C. Thompson of Local Edge Radio in Texas for refreshing my memory on the smallpox as land title claim. He does a great blog at whereistheoutrage.net. I also applaud his fundraising for Haiti, but I'd warn him about directing funds through the Red Cross. Thanks to Mike Sirocco for All Things Web. We go out with you two again, performing the John Lennon classic, Instant Karma, from Amnesty International's Save Darfur CD. Thanks for listening.
Together. Pretty soon you're gonna be dead. What in the world are you thinking of? Laughing in the face of love. What on earth you trying to do? It's up to you, yeah, you. It's the karma's gonna get you. Down you get you right in the face. Get yourself together, darling. Join the human race. Find the world you're gonna see. Laughing at fools like me. What on earth do you think you are? A superstar will write you off. We all shine on. Let the moon, the stars. Your feet. Better recognize your brother. Everyone that you meet.